I want you to soak up the truths of Ephesians 2, 1-10, because this passage helps us to realize how privileged we are, not to be on the defensive, but actually to appreciate that we have some tremendous things to say to the world around us. We don't need to be cowed by negative pictures given of Christians and church in the media. We can be strong because we have things to say which people need to hear. There are all sorts of things, explanations, ideas that people have about life and death. Some of them quite wacky. And actually, I think we, more than anyone, can say meaningful things about what life is about and what death is like. And actually, we've not got a lot of competition when you look at some of the things that people are saying. So, Bill Shankly, a famous quote: "Some people believe football is a matter of life and death." I'm disappointed with that attitude. I can assure you it's much more important than that. I don't know, was that you, Andrew, being presented with the shield there? No? Okay. That was a long time ago, yes. And I'm sorry about the current state of Liverpool Football Club, but in all the days they were a force to be reckoned with. Apart from Bill Shankly not having much of a clue about life and death in a sense. A philosopher by the name of Heinrich Heine from the 19th century said, when asked by a priest on his deathbed if God would forgive him for his sins, he said, "Of course God will forgive me, that's his job." An arrogant, presumptive view of God and his forgiveness, of life after death that he was entitled to, because God should do what God ought to do to forgive him. Canon Henry Scott Holland, who I gather was a canon at St. Paul's Cathedral, has written a piece of prose, poetry, entitled "Death is Nothing at All." I saw this as I was collecting a parcel in the Royal Mail Depot in the other side of Preston, Christian Road, as part of a memorial service I think a former employee at the Royal Mail had held for him. And this attracted my attention because the title was "Death is Nothing at All." And this is what Henry Scott Holland wrote, some of it anyway. "Death is nothing at all. I've only slipped away into the next room. I am I and you are you. Whatever we were to each other, that we still are. Life means all that it ever meant. It's the same that it ever was. There is an absolutely unbroken continuity. Why should I be out of mind because I'm out of sight? I'm waiting for you, for an interval, somewhere very near, just around the corner. All is well." I don't want to take that out of context, but in the overall picture of life and death that we see in the Bible, I'm not sure that's as helpful as it could be from someone who was high up in the church. It seems to be a rather simplistic or naive perspective on life and death. So, you will have heard, I think, some years ago, the advert from the AA advertising their ability to fix things. Roadside accident. Can we fix it? No, I can't, but I know a man who can. That was their strapline. And why are we able to say we have some truth, some insights into what life and death are all about? We can say it because we know a man who does have some insight. We know Jesus. He said to his disciples, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of heaven has been given to you." Paul said to the Corinthian church, "No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit." And even before Jesus, the psalmist wrote, "I have more understanding than all my teachers, for I meditate on all your statutes." We are in a very privileged position because we have an understanding of what life and death are about, not because of our own abilities or cleverness, but because Jesus has revealed that to us, and we live in the Spirit, and by that Spirit we have the mind of Christ. So I want to look at Ephesians chapter 2 and to see a little bit of this remarkable privileged life that we have as Christians and some of the things that we can say to our world. So the first three verses in Ephesians chapter 2. As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. All of us also lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath. This passage shows us the reality of the human condition. Sin has captured us. We are dead in sin. Sin isn't just the occasional weakness of character. We're not victims of unfavorable circumstances. At heart, we're not well-meaning individuals whose better side might be fanned into flame. And we have an essentially noble human character. The passage says we're dead in sins. We used to live in it. It was our habitual condition. And we were held captive to sin by it as we followed the ways of the world. The Greek word for followed there suggests that what we were doing was what we were thinking, what our nature was, what we felt within us. It wasn't something that we were sort of being dragged along, kicking and screaming against our will. This is an expression. Sin is an expression of what we really are. It starts early in life. Andrew this morning referred to, I think, Dr. James Dobson, who quoted a situation with a young child who said, "I did it on my own, did it by myself." I don't remember this, but I think James Dobson must have been at our house sometime. We don't have a picture of him. We do have a video of our two-year-old son, Peter, at that time, saying the words, "I'll do it by my own." I think Granddad was trying to help him with something, but he wasn't for it. "I'll do it by my own." He said that then. We say it ourselves. Perhaps he got it from me, I don't know. But that is our nature. We are independent. We do it by our own. There's something called the Darwin Awards. Heard about this a few days ago. Which is given for people who have killed themselves in sort of stupid ways, expressing their stupidity in that form. And the award is for the fact that, thank goodness, the gene pool is now no longer polluted by their stupidity. So they're given an award because they've done the decent thing and killed themselves. There are also awards for people who haven't been successful in that and have only sort of damaged themselves in stupidity. And there's a guy in the States who had a wasp nest in his garden and, thinking to himself, "I'll do it by my own," rather than get someone in to deal with that wasp nest, decided to sort it. He got his vacuum cleaner out and proceeded to vacuum up this wasp nest, and was very successful. So all the wasps that were there in that bush in the nest are now in his vacuum cleaner. Trouble was he really needed to sort his vacuum cleaner out for his wife later on. To use. So he thought, "Well, now what? What I'll do is I will spray some wasp killer, this sort of aerosol spray, wasp cleaner killer, into the vacuum cleaner, and that will do the trick." The trouble was the vacuum cleaner, having just sucked up the wasp nest, was actually pretty hot. And at the instant that he sprayed his aerosol wasp spray into this vacuum cleaner, the whole thing exploded. And not only was he damaged, but he suffered badly from wasp stings, which was a natural consequence. So he got the Darwin Award. So, I mean, at one level, independence, doing it our way, is a bit funny. It's humorous. But sin, independence from God, is actually quite ugly. Romans 6, Paul says, talking of sin, "What benefit did you reap at that time from the things you are now ashamed of? Those things result in death." Okay, it seems rather humorous when people express their independence in some ways, but actually, independence expressed ultimately is disobedience to God. And those things are shameful. I'm not going to rehearse some of the things that I'm ashamed of. I'm not going to benefit you. I would imagine that all of us have done things we're ashamed of. It's the result of sin, that I in life, which is central to us, which motivates us to go away from God, to say we can sort it ourselves and to do it our way and to do it selfishly. And it's ugly. Gratification is part of what Paul identifies. All of us lived among them at one time, gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature and following its desires and thoughts. Gratifying the cravings of our sinful nature. There's been quite a few high-profile marital indiscretions in the news recently. Tiger Woods, well-known, John Terry, Wayne Rooney. What has surprised me has been the lack of understanding, or lack of ability to explain why these things happen. A lot of it is down to, are they overtrained? You know, is there sort of exposure to the limelight too intense that they trip up occasionally in these ways? What's never mentioned is that it is a moral problem. It's a moral failure that these people have engaged in. And I'm not wanting to sort of pick on them and point fingers. We're all in the situation together. But the media hasn't understood that there's a moral problem. They've had the opportunity to gratify their sinful cravings, if I can be so bold, and the power and the influence and all those things, and that has been a result. It's a moral problem, gratifying the sinful cravings, the cravings of our sinful natures. And then, finally, in this short section, wrath is our destiny. Like the rest, we were by nature objects of wrath. Hebrews 9:27 says, just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that to face judgment. There is an accounting required for all people. I think one of the things I feel about the world is that although we're all, people are pretty mixed up about what's right and wrong, I think there is still a sense of morality, that there is still a sense that wrong things cannot go unpunished. It's unfair for people who do wrong things to get away with it. I think that is still there. Interestingly enough, in the when you look at the tabloids, when they talk about the John Terriers and the Tiger Woods and the Wayne Rooneys, they have these dramatic headlines, love rat or love cheat. And I'm hardly going to advocate that the tabloids are sort of particularly moral. But in a sense, there is a sense of that was wrong. You know, they have committed to someone. Why have they done this? And there is a sense in our world that it is a moral world. And we need to reinforce that because it is a world where we will be held to account. The problem is, it isn't just the people who do the obvious wrong things who are to be held to account. All of us have done things wrong. All of us have done things we're ashamed of. All of us will fall short of God's standards. And I suppose that's the bad news. We saw it with the MP's expenses scandals as well, didn't we? A sense of this is wrong, something needs to be done. There is still some appreciation that we are in a moral world, and we as Christians should stand up for that and say, yes, it is a moral world. God is still in charge. We will give account. Every action, every deed, every thought is being considered by God. Now, that's pretty scary until you get to the next section. The passage goes on. The wonder of a merciful God. Let me just have my... another passage. But because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in transgressions. It's by grace you have been saved. And God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in the heavenly realms in Christ Jesus, in order that in the coming ages he might show the incomparable riches of his grace expressed in his kindness to us in Christ Jesus. It's a moral world. All of us are going to be held to account. And then Paul says, but because of his great love for us, God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ. That's the hope that we have. Some people see God as somewhat dispassionate. And maybe they're lumping the Lord that we know with other gods, idols that people worship. And one can understand, they appear dispassionate. Let me encourage you to read about God in the Old Testament. God is a God who wears his heart on his sleeve in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, Jesus bleeds for people. In the Old Testament, God bleeds for people too. It's almost embarrassing, to be honest, when you read the Old Testament and some of the prophets, and they record the love that God feels for his people and the heartache that he has when they turn away from him. God is a God who bleeds. He is a God of emotion. He loves his people. So I want to encourage you to get into the Old Testament and see afresh the love of God. Love is the language that we're used to in our society. It's always been the case. Don't know whether you're into Comedy Roadshow with Michael McIntyre. Some of us maybe. Michael McIntyre, you remember. Give all your love to. You know, he introduces the next act. Give all your love to this person. X Factor. The judges lined up. They've heard a singer. We love you. You know, they express these things. We feel, perhaps we're recoiling a little bit, because we feel love is deeper than that. But it is the language of our society. People might allow the words to trip off their tongues very easily, but it is what people yearn for. It's what people look for in life. A God who not only loves us, but a God who forgives us. We were made alive with Christ when we were dead in transgressions because God has forgiven us. I read a book on marriage, or maybe I just dipped into it, perhaps that was it. I dipped into a book on marriage, and I read the start of one chapter, and it said, if I'm correct, you should contemplate the affair from the very first day you're married. You should contemplate the affair from the very first day you're married. And I think that's actually good advice. I've been contemplating the affair, not having one, but I've been contemplating the impact that an affair would have in our marriage, Caroline and myself. I can only compare it to someone who commits adultery. It must be like a suicide bomber. You know, they blow everyone else and themselves to bits through what they do. I thought about how I might respond if Caroline was unfaithful. Could I forgive? Would I forgive? It eats you. It makes you sick to contemplate how you would handle that. And I thought to myself, this is getting towards how God forgives. We are unfaithful to God. His people have been unfaithful to God. In the Old Testament, his people have constantly been unfaithful to God. And yet he yearns for them to be back with him. I'm unfaithful to God in a variety of ways. And I trip in and ask his forgiveness and expect to receive it. And the amazing thing is, I do receive it. I am forgiven. We all are forgiven when we ask God to forgive. But if you comprehend a little bit of what it might be like, this depth of forgiveness, which, you know, I'm struggling with this. You know, how would I cope if my wife was unfaithful and she came back and said, will you forgive me? Could I do that? And yet that's only a small piece of how God forgives us. His forgiveness is just remarkable. So, a God who loves us, a God who forgives us, a God who enjoys us. He has seated us with him in the heavenly realms, seated us with Christ in the heavenly realms. I saw a sad thing 2 days ago as I was going down the motorway, a broken down lorry on the far hard shoulder. Now, some of us, you know, we've had the lorry drivers up the back of us at 70 miles an hour, a foot away, and we don't mind seeing broken down lorries. That's good. We're happy. But anyway, it wasn't that was a problem. It was the fact that on this broken down lorry was this advert saying, Gretna Football Club, living the dream. Now, some of us know, the football people here know that Gretna Football Club shot to meteoric fame in Scotland by getting into the Scottish Premier League through a large injection of cash, I suppose is the honest truth. They came from very low down in the leagues, they shot to the top, and they were living the dream. Fantastic. Now, of course, Gretna don't exist. They went out of business, they couldn't pay their way, things happened. Enjoyment in this life can be short-lived. But here we say, or here Paul says, God raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in order that in the coming ages he might show the incomparable riches of his grace expressed in his kindness to us in Christ. God enjoys his people. And this is not just a sort of passing phase. It's not going to be like Gretna Football Club. God commits to this for the coming ages. This is a wonderful thing we can look forward to. We are already there. God raised us up and seated us with Christ. This has happened. And we're going to experience some tremendous kindnesses of his grace. This is not the seatedness, should I say, of Ryan Airways. Our family went to Italy this summer. Finally got us... I was forced, basically, to book a foreign holiday for once after several years of camping. So anyway, we're heading off to Italy and we get Ryanair via Liverpool. So we've printed out our tickets ourselves, got ourselves through checkout and walking up the steps into the plane. And at this point I'm realising, well, hang on, we don't have any seats on our tickets. Are we in the right place? Am I? You know, is this the right plane? Should I be here? Should we be here? Here's an air hostess, whatever her name is. We'll ask her. Where do we sit? There's no numbers on our tickets. She says, sit anywhere. So we're heading down the aisle, trying to sort of get past people who are putting their bags in the lockers at the top and find some sort of seats. Try and get to the seats by the sort of escape hatches, I suppose, possibly, along with the others. Aren't you meant to sit there? But possibly you're meant to sit there. That's the best place. It's mayhem on this plane. We're trying to find a place to sit. Who knows? They might have overbooked. We might not have a seat if we don't get in there fast enough. Now, I don't imagine that's anything like seatedness with British Airways business class. I expect if I get down to British Airways... You know, not that I've ever done this, there may be some people who've been fortunate enough to go business class, but I expect, you know, up the top of the steps on the from the apron, the air stewardess says, "Welcome, Mr. Billsborough. How nice to see you. We hope you have a very pleasant flight, sir." Thank you. Seat, where shall I sit? Mr. Billsborough, the pilot has asked if you'd like to sit with him. So I get called up, to sit in the cockpit with a pilot. I'm a bit worried because I think this could be expensive. You know, maybe we have to buy drinks for the pilot. I don't know. I say to the stewardess, what about food and drink? Do we have to pay for that? Mr. Bilzer, this is all complimentary. Now, that's what seatedness in God's perspective is like. It's not Ryanair, it's British Airways. He seated us with Christ to express in the coming ages the incomparable riches of his grace, kindness to us in Christ. Then the third and final section, Verse 8 to 10, for it's by grace you've been saved through faith, not from yourselves, it's the gift of God, not by works so that no one can boast. For we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which God prepared in advance for us to do. People are desperate for justice, I suppose, in life. They don't want to see bad people get away with the bad things. They're desperate for love. It's a universal need that people pursue. But they're also desperate for purpose. I don't know how most people handle retirement. It may be a great opportunity to get time with the grandchildren and what have you, do all those things you've never been able to do but wanted to do. But maybe for some people it's a difficult time. What is the purpose that they should pursue now? I don't know whether you ever reflect on just life. You know, when you go out in a day, all these people rushing around being busy. What are we being busy about? We're sort of sustaining human existence for what? Well, for the next day, or maybe for the next generation. What is it all for? Maybe I just ask too many questions. I don't know. Maybe I've got too much time to think about things, but you wonder, what is life about, really? But for the Christian, there is the prospect of purpose. It's a life free from pressure. You know, we're not here tonight because of our cleverness, because we've done good things, good deeds. We're here by the grace of God, because he has said, you cannot do anything to justify my forgiveness. You're here by grace alone. It's a life free from pressure. It's a life full of purpose. I spoke before the reading tonight about how God had worked and provided a job for me. And in that, you know, I sense that there is significant purpose for me. God has provided this. God has worked. There are things that I'm called to do with him in that situation, which gives me some deep underlying sense of fulfillment that this is good. Life is good. I feel enriched. That may be a little bit selfish, but it, you know what I mean. God provides us with a purpose, things to do. I felt enriched. And then it's a life founded on preparation. God prepared these works in advance for us to do. This next weekend is the youth weekend away. And I seem to remember last year, Andrew, you said youth weekend away, all you parents who've got kids on that weekend away, get yourself away for a romantic weekend. Do you remember that? All right. He said that last year, okay? He said, if you're away, you know, great opportunity for parents who've got kids on the youth weekend to get away for a weekend together. Fantastic. So this year, Caroline and I are going away for a weekend. Yep. And we're going down to London. And I've prepared in advance some works to do. We'll be going. She knows about them. I've booked the Eye, London Eye. We'll get on that for half an hour. We'll take a show. We will go to Westminster Abbey on Sunday morning. That'll be fantastic. We will possibly go to a National Trust property in the London area. I prepared in advance for these works, but don't expect her to be off on her own on these. You know, I'm going to be with her. I've prepared in advance, and I'm part of the deal. God has prepared in advance good works for us to do, but he doesn't kick us out the door and say, you're on your own, I'm doing other things. God is engaging with us in these good works. They will be good works. They will give us this sense of purpose which we yearn for, because God has made us for that, and God has prepared in advance. I think Caroline is feeling pleased that I've taken the trouble to prepare in advance. I know she wouldn't be pleased if I hadn't prepared in advance, so that's good. But, you know, she's enjoying the fact that it's got sorted, thank you, and she's looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it. But God has prepared in advance for us to do good works. He's called us into partnership with him for these things. So, We are very privileged people. We're loved by God. We've been forgiven. We're called into relationship with Him. We have a life of purpose which He gives us. We have got things to say to people around us. We're privileged, but we can also say some very positive things. We can say to the world, you want to see justice? That's on the heart of God. He is a God who loves justice, who will do what is right. You want to know love? You want to experience real love, not love which is superficial and sickly and inconstant? God is a God who loves you. He's loved you to the depth that He forgives you for the things you've done wrong, the things of which you're ashamed, and He's forgiven you because of Jesus. And that expresses the depth and the consistency of His love to you. And you're looking for purpose in life? God has got some things in store for you. God has thought about these in advance. You're not an afterthought in God's plans. You have the prospect of a purposeful life. So, we can be encouraged by how privileged we are and how much we have to say to our world around us. Dave?